Okay, let's hope I can read better than I can chant. So, for today's reading, I'm going to read the introduction and one of the talks from Ajahn Lee Damodaro, Keeping the Breath in Mind. And so I chose this reading because when I first went to Thailand, some of the books of Ajahn Sumedho were the first kind of books I read on Thai forest tradition. And this is the Keeping the Breath in Mind is the first Thai monk that I had had read his teachings. So I thought I'd kind of go back to the beginning for myself. Ajahn Lee was born in 1906 and died at the very young age of 55 in 1961. And he's kind of the primary teacher of Ajahn Jeff. And he's the translator of this. So I'll start with the introduction. Is there had he gone to start Wapapong with Ajahn Chah? Is there a story that he had gone with Ajahn Chah to start Wapapong and then left? What's that?
He's dying.
Yeah.
Yeah. No. Okay. No. There's. That, I mean, that, but the story that kind of might be conflated with that is Lupa Put, who is another disciple of Ajahn, his primary teacher was Ajahn Sam, but he practiced and trained with Ajahn Mun also. And Lupa Put went to Wapapong, and Lumbapur is very highly regarded, and so he went to Wapapong to practice in the forest there, and the villagers got all excited and invited him to stay, and wanting a more like a forest monastery, and Lumbapur said, "No. It won't be long and the owner will be here." and Ajahn Chah came, it was about a year or two later.
Okay, so from Ajahn Lee.
Lupa Put was also the monk who advised us to chant the... when Ajahn Chah was ill, that chanting the chant the deep imagination for Ajahn Chah. He likes to contemplate. So that's when we started chanting the Vipassana Bhumi on a weekly basis, and also said, when Ajahn Chah was, this was like, maybe only like a year or so after he was really bedridden, and he went to see Ajahn Chah, and he's very renowned for his, sort of his meditation, psychic powers, so he sort of went into meditation and beside Ajahn Chah, and then when he came out of meditation, he said, "Ajahn Chah's fine." He said, "His mind is incredibly bright." He's fine. You don't have to worry about him, but he does like to contemplate.
This book is a guide to the practice of centering the mind. There are two sections. The first deals almost exclusively with the mind, but because the well-being of the mind depends to some extent on the body, I have included a section, Method 2, that shows how to use the body to benefit the mind. From what I've observed in my own practice, there's only one path that is short, easy, and effective, and pleasant, and at the same time has hardly anything to lead you astray. the path of keeping the breath in mind, the same path the Lord Buddha himself used with such good results. But I hope that you won't make things difficult for yourself by being hesitant or uncertain, by taking this or that teaching from here or there, and that, instead, you'll earnestly set your mind on getting in touch with your own breath and following it as far as it can take you. From there, you will enter the stage of liberating insight, leading to the mind itself. Ultimately, pure knowing, Buddha, will stand out on its own. That's when you'll reach the attainment worthy and trustworthy and sure. In other words, if you let the breath follow its own nature and the mind its own nature, the results of your practice will without a doubt be all that you hoped for. Ordinarily, the nature of the heart, if it isn't trained and put into order, is to fall into with preoccupations that are stressful and bad. This is why we have to search for a principle, a Dhamma, that which to train ourselves if we hope for happiness that is stable and secure. If our hearts have no inner principle, no center in which to dwell, we're like a person without a home. Homeless people have nothing but hardship. The sun, wind, rain, and dirt are bound to leave them constantly soiled because they have nothing to act as shelter. To practice centering the mind is to build a home for yourself. Momentary concentration, kanika samadhi, is like a house roofed with thatch. Threshold concentration, upachara samadhi, a house roofed with a tile. In fixed penetration, apana samadhi, a house built out of bricks. Once you have a home, you'll have a safe place to keep your valuables. You won't have to put up with the hardships of watching over them, the way a person who has no place to keep his valuables has to go sleeping in the open, exposed to the sun and rain, to guard those valuables, and even then his valuables aren't really safe. So it is with the uncentered mind. If he goes searching for good from other areas, letting its thoughts wander around in all kinds of concepts and preoccupations, even if those thoughts are good, they still can't say that they're safe. They're like a woman with plenty of jewelry. If she dresses up in her jewelry and goes wandering around, she's not safe at all. Her wealth might even lead to her own death. In the same way, if our hearts aren't trained through meditation to gain inner stillness, even the virtues we've been able to develop will deteriorate easily because they aren't yet secure and stashed away in the heart. To train the mind to attain stillness and peace, though, is like keeping your valuables in a strong box. This is why most of us don't get any good from the good that we do. We let the mind fall under the sway of our various preoccupations. These preoccupations are our enemies, because there are times when you can cause the virtues you've already developed to wither away. The mind is like a blooming flower. The wind and insects, if wind and insects disturb the flower, it can't have a chance to give fruit. The flower here stands for the stillness of the mind on the path. The fruits for the happiness of the path's fruition. If our stillness of mind and happiness are constant, we have a chance to attain the ultimate good we hope for. The ultimate good is like the heartwood of a tree. Other goods, like the buds, branches, and leaves, if we haven't trained our heart and minds, we'll meet with things that are good only on the external level. But if our hearts are pure and good within, everything external will flow in, becoming good as a result. Just as our hand, if it's clean, won't soil what it touches, but if it's dirty, will soil even the cleanest cloth. In the same way, if the heart is defiled, everything is defiled. Even the good we do will be defiled. For the highest power in the world, the sole power giving rise to all good and evil, pleasure and pain, is the heart. The heart is like a god. Good, evil, pleasure, pain come entirely from the heart. We could even call the heart the creator of the world, because the peace and continued well-being of the world depends on the heart. If the world is to be destroyed, it will be because of the heart. So we should train this most important part of the world to be centered as a foundation for the wealth and well-being. Centering the mind is a way of gathering together all its skillful potentials. When these potentials are gathered in the right proportions, they'll give you strength you need to destroy your enemies, all of your defilements and unwise mental states. You have discernment that you've trained and made wise in the ways of good and evil, of the world and the Dhamma. Your discernment is like gunpowder. If you keep your gunpowder for long without putting it into bullets, a centered mind, it'll go damp and moldy. Or if you're careless and let the fires of greed, anger, and delusion overcome you, your gunpowder will flare up in your hands. So don't delay. Put your gunpowder into bullets so that whenever your enemies, your defilements, make an attack, you'll be able to shoot them right down. Whoever trains the mind to be centered gains a refuge. The centered mind is like a fortress. Discernment is like a weapon. To practice centering the mind is to secure yourself in a fortress, and so is something very worthwhile and important. I like this next paragraph. Virtue, the first part of the path, and discernment, the last, aren't especially difficult, but keeping the mind centered, which is the middle part, takes some effort because it's a matter of forcing the mind into shape. Admittedly, centering the mind, like placing bridge pilings in the middle of a river, is something difficult to do. But once the mind is firmly in place, it can be very useful in developing virtue and discernment. Virtue is like placing pilings on the near shore of a river, discernment like placing them on the far shore. But if the middle pilings, a centered mind, aren't firmly in place, how will you ever be able to bridge the flood of suffering? There's only one way we can properly reach the qualities of Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and that's through the practice of mental development, bhavana. When we develop the mind to be centered and still, discernment can arise. Discernment here refers not to ordinary discernment, but to the insight that comes solely from dealing directly with the mind. For example, the ability to remember past lives, to know where living beings are reborn after death, and to cleanse the heart of the fermentations, the asavas, of defilements. These three forms of intuition, termed jnana chakku, the eye of the mind, can arise for people who train themselves in the area of the heart and mind. But if we go around searching for knowledge from sights, sounds, smells, taste, and tactile sensations, mixed together with concepts, it's as if we're studying from the six masters, and we can't see clearly the truth, just as the Buddha, while he was studying with the six masters, wasn't able to gain awakening. He then turned his attention to his own heart and mind and went off to practice on his own, keeping track of his breath as his first step and going all the way to the ultimate goal. As long as you're still searching for knowledge from your six senses, you're studying with the six masters. But when you focus your attention on the breath, which exists in each of us, to the point where the mind settles down and is centered, you'll have the chance to meet with the real thing, Buddha, pure knowing. Some people believe that they don't have to practice centering the mind, that they can attain release through discernment, panya vimutti, by working with discernment alone. This simply isn't true. Both release through discernment and release through stillness of mind, chaito vimutti, are based on centering the mind. They differ only in degrees. Like walking, ordinarily a person doesn't walk on one leg alone. Whichever leg is heavier is simply a matter of personal habit and traits. Release through discernment begins by pondering various events and aspects of the world until the mind slowly comes to rest, and once it's still, gives rise intuitively to liberating insight, vipassana jnana, clear and true understanding in terms of the Four Noble Truths, Arya Satya. In release through stillness of mind, though, there's not much pondering involved. The mind is simply forced to be quiet until it attains the stage of fixed penetration. That's where intuitive insight will arise, enable it to see things for what they are. This is release through stillness of the mind. Concentration comes first, discernment later. A person with a wide-ranging knowledge of the text, well-versed in their letters of meaning, capable of clearly and correctly explaining various points of doctrine, but with no inter-center of the mind, is like a pilot flying about in an airplane with a clear view of the clouds and stars, but no sense of where the landing strip is. He's headed for trouble. If he flies higher, he'll run out of air. All he can do is keep flying around until he runs out of fuel and comes crashing down into the savage wilds. Some people, even though they're highly educated, are no better than savages in their behavior. This is because they've gotten carried away up in the clouds. Some people, taken with what they feel to be high levels of their own learning, ideas, and opinions, won't practice centering the mind because they feel it's beneath them. They think they deserve to go straight to release through discernment instead. Actually, they're heading straight for disaster, like the airplane pilot who has lost sight of the landing strip. To practice centering the mind is to build a landing strip for yourself. Then, when discernment comes, you'll be able to attain release safely. This is why we have to develop all three parts of the path: virtue, concentration, and discernment, if we want to be complete in our practice of the religion. Otherwise, how can we say that we know the Four Noble Truths? Because the path, the quality of the Noble Path, has to be composed of virtue, concentration, and discernment. If we don't develop it within ourselves, we can't know it. And if we don't know it, how can we let go? Most of us, by and large, like getting results but don't like laying the groundwork. We may want nothing but goodness and purity, but if we haven't completed the groundwork, we'll have to keep on being poor, like people who are fond of money but not of work. How can they be good, solid citizens when they feel the pinch for when they feel the pinch of poverty? They'll turn to corruption and crime. In the same way, if we aim at results in the field of the religion but don't like doing the work, we'll have to continue being poor. And as long as our hearts are poor, we're bound to go searching for goodness in other areas: greed, gain, status, praise, pleasure, the baits of the world, even though we know better. This is because we don't truly know, which means simply that we aren't true in what we do. The truth of the path is always true. Virtue is something true. Concentration is true. Discernment is true. Release is true. But if we aren't true, we won't meet with anything true. And if we aren't true in practicing virtue, concentration, and discernment, we'll end up with only the things that are fake and imitation. And when we make use of things fake and imitation, we're headed for trouble. So we have to be true in our hearts. When our hearts are true, we'll come to savor the taste of Dhamma, a taste surpassing all the taste of the world. This is why I've put together the following two guides for keeping the breath in mind. So I'm going to read one of his talks called The Art of Letting Go. This was April 17th, 1956. When you sit and meditate, even if you don't gain any intuitive insight, make sure at least you know this much. When you breathe, when the breath comes in, you know. When it goes out, you know. When it's long, you know. When it's short, you know. Whether it's comfortable or uncomfortable, you know. If you can know this much, you're doing fine. As for the various thoughts and concepts, sanya, that come into the mind, brush them away. Whether they're good or bad, whether they deal with the past or the future, don't let them interfere with what you're doing, and don't go chasing after them to straighten them out. When a thought of this sort comes passing in, simply let it pass on, keeping your awareness unperturbed in the present. When we say that the mind goes here or there, it's not really the mind that goes. Only concepts go. Concepts are like shadows of the mind. If the body is still, how will its shadow move? The movement of the body is what causes shadows to move. And when the shadows move, how will you catch hold of it? Shadows are hard to catch, hard to shake off, hard to set still. Awareness that forms the present, that's the true mind. Awareness that goes chasing after concepts is like a shadow. Real awareness, knowing, stays in place. It doesn't stand, walk, come, or go. As for the mind, the awareness that doesn't act in any way, coming or going, forward or back, is quiet and unperturbed. And when the mind is thus normal, even undistracted self, i.e., when it doesn't have any shadows, we can rest peacefully. But if the mind is unstable, uncertain, and wavering, concepts arise and go, flashing out, and we go chasing after them, hoping to drag them back in. Chasing after them is where we go wrong. This is what we have to control. Tell yourself, nothing is wrong with your mind. Just watch out for the shadows. You can't improve your shadows. Say your shadow is black. You can scrub it with soap till your dying day, and it'll still be black. But there's no because there's no substance to it. So it is with your concepts. You can't straighten them out because they're just images deceiving you. The Buddha taught us that whatever isn't acquainted with the body, with the self, the body and mind, and its shadows, is suffering from avidya, darkness, deluded knowledge. Whoever thinks the mind is the self is the mind is its concept. Whoever has things mixed up like this is deluded and lost, like a person lost in the jungle. To be lost in the jungle brings countless hardships. There are wild beasts to worry about, problems in finding food to eat, a place to sleep. No matter which way you look, there's no way out. But if you're lost in the world, it's many times worse than being lost in the jungle, because you can't tell night from day. We have no chance to find any brightness because our minds are dark with avidya. The purpose of training the mind is to be still, is to simplify things. When things are simplified, the mind can settle down and rest. And when the mind has rested, it'll gradually become bright in and of itself and give rise to knowledge. But if we let things get complicated, if we let the mind get mixed up with sights, sounds, smells, tastes, tactile sensations, and ideas, that's darkness. Knowledge won't have a chance to arise. When intuitive knowledge does arise, it can, if you know how to use it, lead to liberating insight. But if you let yourself get carried away by knowledge of the past and future, you won't get beyond the mundane level. In other words, if you dabble too much in knowledge of physical things without gaining wisdom and with regards to the workings of the mind, it can leave you spiritually immature. Say, for example, that a vision arises and you get hooked. You gain knowledge of your past lives and get all excited. Things you never knew before, now you know. Things you never saw before, now you see. And they can make you overly pleased or upset. Why? Because you take them all too seriously. You may see a vision of yourself prospering as a lord or master, a great emperor or king, wealthy or influential. If you let yourself feel pleased, that's indulgence and pleasure. You've strayed from the middle path. Or if you see yourself as something you wouldn't care to be, a pig, a dog, a fish, a rat, crippled or defiled, if you let yourself get upset, that's indulgence and self-affliction, and again you strayed from the path. Some people really let themselves get carried away. As soon as they start seeing things, they begin to think they're special, somehow better than other people. They let themselves become proud and conceited, and the right path has disappeared without their even knowing it. If you're not careful, this is where mundane knowledge can lead you. But if you keep one principle firmly in mind, you can stay right on the path. Whatever happens, good or bad, true or false, don't let yourself feel pleased. Don't let yourself get upset. Keep the mind balanced and neutral, and discernment will arise. You'll see that the vision or signs display the truth of stress. It's arising, fades, and disappears. Is born, ages, and dies. If you get hooked on your intuitions, you're asking for trouble. Knowledge that proves false can hurt you. Knowledge that proves true can really hurt you. If what you know is true, and you go telling other people, you're bragging. If it turns out false, it can backfire on you. This is why those who truly know say that knowledge is the essence of stress. It can hurt you. Knowledge is part of the flood of views and opinions, ditti-oga, over which we have to cross. If you hang on to knowledge, you've gone wrong. If you know, simply know and let it go at that. You don't have to be excited or pleased. You don't have to go telling other people. People who've studied abroad, when they come back to the rice fields, don't tell what they've learned to the folks at home. They talk about ordinary things in an ordinary way. The reason they don't talk about things they've studied is, one, no one would understand them, and two, it doesn't serve any purpose. Even with people who would understand them, they don't display their learning. So it should be with those who practice meditation. No matter how much you know, you have to act as if you know nothing, because this is the way people with good manners normally act. If you go bragging to other people, it's bad enough. If they don't believe you, it can get even worse. So whatever you know, simply be aware of it and let it go. Don't let there be the assumption that I know. When you can do this, your mind can attain the transcendent, free from attachment. Everything in the world has its truth. Even things that aren't true are true. Their truth is that they're false. This is why we have to let go of both what's true and what's false. Once we know the truth and can let it go, we can be at our ease. We won't be poor, because the truth, the Dhamma, will still be there with us. We won't be left empty-handed. It's like having a lot of money. Instead of lugging it around with us, we keep it piled up at home. We may not have anything in our pockets, but we're still not poor. The same is true with people who really know. Even when they let go of their knowledge, it's still there. This is why the minds of the noble ones aren't left adrift. They let things go, but not in a wasteful or irresponsible way. They let go like rich people. Even though they let go, they've still got piles of wealth. As for people who let things go like paupers, they don't know what's worthwhile and what's not. When they throw away the things that are worthwhile, they're simply heading for disaster. For instance, they may see that there's no truth to anything, no truth to the khandhas, no truth to the body, no truth to stress, its cause, its disbanding, or the path to its disbanding, no truth to liberation. They don't use their brains at all. They're too lazy to do anything. So they let go of everything, throw it all away. This is called letting go like a pauper. Like a lot of modern-day sages, when they come back after they die, they're going to be poor all over again. As for the Buddha, he let go only of the true and false things that appeared in the body and mind, but he didn't abandon his body and mind, which is why he ended up rich, with plenty of wealth to hand down to his descendants. This is why his descendants never have to worry about being poor. So we should look to the Buddha as our model. If we see that the khandhas are worthless, inconstant, stressful, not self, and all that, and simply let go of them by neglecting them, we're sure to end up poor, like a stupid person who feels so repulsed by festering sore in his body that he won't touch it, and so lets it go without taking care of it. There's no way the sore is going to heal. As for intelligent people, they know how to wash their sores, put medicine and bandages on them, so that eventually they're sure to recover. In the same way, when people see only the drawbacks to the khandhas without seeing their good side, and so let them go without putting them to any worthwhile or skillful use, nothing good will come of it. But if we're intelligent enough to see that the khandhas have their good sides as well as their bad, and then put them to good use by meditating to gain discernment into physical and mental phenomena, we're going to be rich, whether we have the truth. Once we have the truth, the Dhamma, as our wealth, we won't suffer if we have money. We won't suffer if we don't. For our minds will be transcendent. The various forms of rust, greed, anger, and delusion that have been obscuring the senses will fall away. Our eyes, ears, nose, tongue, and body will be entirely clean, clear, and bright. For, as the Buddha said, the Dhamma, discernment, is like a lamp. Our mind, far distant from all forms of trouble and suffering, will stay in the current flow on to liberation. So that's the reading.
Does anyone know what the Thai word that Ajahn Jeff is translating preoccupations is? It came up a couple times in the first talk.
I was wondering if that was the same word he always translates as suppositions when he was translating Ajahn Chah, or concepts, thoughts and concepts.
A bit different. I don't know, maybe. Yeah, I don't know. Hard to say. Could be a wrong preoccupation. That's my mood. No, you translate it as mood.
Prudent.
Yeah, maybe. Well, that prudent isn't
privilege.
That's kind of used in as a Dhamma phrase. It's fairly, like, that's 1956 that he wrote that, or Thomas spoke that. Or that he wrote it
formally.
It was, I don't know that it was used in a former. It was fairly modern.
I was just wondering if another English translation would have been like your habits of your mind, because like the sentence is, ordinarily the nature of the heart, if it isn't trained and put into order, will fall into its preoccupations that are stressful and bad. Like it just falls into its habitual habits.
Yeah, actually, a role is probably a good use of moods.
Was there any contact between the sphere of Nanacha Papapong, yourself, Mokwacha, and then the sphere of Vaisokaram, Tampoli, Tampofu, Ajahn Jeff? Did you know that?
Yeah. Absolutely not.
Absolutely.
Although I don't know, even when Ajahn Anand set up his monastery across the valley from Lumpafuran. Ajahn Lee died in 1961. He died in 1961. That was very early. Those were early days, and that was central Thailand. It was it really was another country. and it wasn't actually that long prior to that in Ubon, the division between Mahanipai and Dhammi was very, very strong. Used to be fist fights on Pindabak or Ubon between the Mahanipai and the Dhammi. It's not very beautiful.
Do you have any idea why it was so strong?
Oh, it was all done your fault. Those dummies. No, that was a bit of something else. It came up in talking about it in when I was a one-hour child. And somebody sort of flippantly sort of asked, oh, you know, who won? Yeah, nobody wins. Fist fights and pinball. But yeah, a lot of contention between the doggy and mind. And Ajahn Chah was one of the a big reason why there was an increased respect for Mahanipai and also the standards of Dhamma was sliding for quite some time. So that there was a very contentious for a long time.
Was the Vinabhat group contentious? It was because they were in territorial about whose group it was, or it's just that was just the interface.
It's just the human nature. And Obon is Obon in particular is if you go like downtown sort of Obon, the old Obon, now it's when with the Vietnam War then it really expanded. Obon was you could hardly walk a block without being at another monastery. And it was all there's a big mixture of Dhamma youth and Lankai monasteries in Obon. So it's a lot of monasteries. It's always been a big center.
Before I can show, were there any Monica teachers that were in your sect?
Yeah, but not well known. Say like Ajahn Kindani, Ajahn Tonglat, they were always held in high regard. And like Ajahn Kindani, Ajahn Tonglat in particular was held in very high regard because he was such a character. Ajahn Kindani was held in high regard because he was such a good solid monk. And they lived and practiced with the Dhamma youth monks and with Ajahn Lam. So that's who Ajahn Chah studied under them. Ajahn Tonglat was from Obon as well, and Ajahn Kinnerly was from further up the Kompano area.
You said they studied with Ajahn Lam?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So Ajahn Chah wasn't an anomaly in that respect?
No, he wasn't an anomaly. But they were, and they were, say, like a previous generation.
Poor. Were they in the Ubon? They were in Ubon? Yeah. The Ajahn Tonglat and...
Ajahn Tonglat was in Ubon. Ajahn Kinnerly was up in the Kompano, which is north, a couple hundred kilometers north of Ubon. closer to the area where the majority of Dhamma monasteries were established. Ajahn Lam sort of made his home base.
So would it be safe to say that among like three or four songs, true practitioners, like you're describing, sort of Mahanakai Dhamma differences, it didn't really matter, and it was amongst.
It didn't. I mean, it was. It didn't really matter in terms of practice. It did in terms of actual living together. They were. it's hard to say. I don't know what the standards were, but even in former times, and doing Patimokkha together was really not. I don't think that was really allowed. I don't know what say with either of those teachers, what happened when it came to be a Uposatha day, a big piece of being a monk and living in community is doing Patimokkha together, sharing Patimokkha. So yeah, I don't know what standards were held, but I think it was held a lot tighter than it's like as it still is today in many monasteries, the Mahanikaya and Dhamma youth don't Ajahn Ban was one of the first monks to regularly allow the manika to do. I mean, if you have a good standard of Vinaya, there's never a problem for Wapapong monks to do Patimokkha with Ajahn Ban. But Ajahn Ban is not of the, say, he was more like, his teacher was a direct disciple of Ajahn Lam. And I don't think Mahanikaya monks were ever did Patimokkha Ajahn Mahabhu. That's a different standard.